A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words that we welcome you every week on the Time of Monsters podcast, I'm Jeet here. The podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine. It's widely available on all podcasting platforms. This week, we're going to talk about someone who's, I don't think I would call a monster, but maybe a problematic fave, as the kids say, which is Betty Friedan, who's a major figure in second wave feminism, has always been, you know, a kind of center of controversy, including from people who have shared her politics, but is has a huge legacy, and a legacy that I actually think is like perhaps more relevant now than it's ever been. And to talk about Betty Friedan, I'm very happy to have on frequent flyer on the In Time of Foot Monsters podcast, frequent flyer program, Moira Donegan, who is a columnist at The Guardian, a fellow at Stanford University, and also has her own quite excellent podcast, which I would encourage people to check out, and I will put a link to it, called In Bed with the Right, where she and Adrian Daub talk about right wing, the intersection between right wing politics and gender reaction, and among the delights of the podcast, they talk about people who are longtime bête noirs or problematic, not faves but problematic villains like Midge Dector, who listeners of this podcast will be very familiar with, as a sort of underrated supervillain of post-war American life. So let's talk about Betty Friedan, and maybe the way to start it is just like, you know, as I mentioned, she's like on the one hand a very major figure, but has always been, you know, at the center of a storm of controversy. So maybe like just like outlining, you know, like what her achievements are, but then also what are some of the questions that people have had about her.
Yeah, so Betty Friedan is a person who was irascible and difficult. She had, you know, outbursts of rage, and she made some real misjudgments. And, you know, some of those were motivated by what I think you can fairly call just like plain personal bigotry, right? Mm-hmm. And also, she dramatically changed gender relations in America. She dramatically changed federal policy. She was a sort of founder in this way of the second wave feminist movement that without her, it would never have happened. And our lives would not look the way they did. I think they would look tremendously worse if it were not for Betty Friedan, right? So this is, you know, one of these figures of history who was personally small and politically quite outsized, right? She had these principles and ambitions that her personal character didn't really match up to. It was part of why I really loved spending a lot of time with her recently when I wrote a review for The New Yorker of these two new books that cover the second wave and Betty Friedan in particular.
Yeah, well, let's maybe try to situate her a bit more, like in sort of history. Like she's born in 1921. Is initially like sort of politicized into the radical left. Is a Communist Party member. Has I think in your piece you mentioned she's like too intellectual for the Communist Party.
Yeah. So maybe let's give a little bit of like background for anybody who's just like, who the hell is Betty Friedan? Oh, so she's the author of a book that came out in 1963 called The Feminine Mystique, which was a account of what Betty saw as a really a moment of anti-feminist backlash that had occurred in the 1940s and 50s and that had left American women worse off than they had been before that period, right? So Betty Friedan in The Feminine Mystique, The Feminine Mystique is sort of thought of as like the housewives liberation book, right? She is critiquing a ideal of white middle class American womanhood that keeps women out of the public sphere and devoted to sort of hearth and home and homemaking and childrearing, right? And Betty, who had a background in psychology, she had gone to graduate school for psychology, understood this role as very psychically claustrophobic for the women who were placed into it. And she also saw it as a historical anomaly. I think now, from our perch, we can sort of use the 1950s as a shorthand for this like pre-feminist gender status quo, right? Like what it was before we all awoke to feminism, but feminism long predates the 1950s. And the 1940s and 50s gender relation status that sort of created that 1950s housewife, Betty Cleaver, feminine mystique era was the product of a real political project to get women out of the workforce, white middle class women back into the home and having more babies. That was, deliberate. And Betty Friedan really traces that project and sort of incited with her book, which was a massive bestseller, this sort of awakening of women to a rediscovery of feminism that a lot of them had sort of thought of as passé and left behind.
Yeah, no, I that book kind of made her, like one of the early and rare feminist stars of the period. I mean, just thinking about it historically, like the only other comparable figure would be someone like Simone de Beauvoir with like The Second Sex, which was also like roughly around the same time. But there wasn't, I mean, there was not a lot of precisely because of that sort of backlash and suppression of feminism. Like the older feminist stars, were not really visible anymore. Even the ones that were alive, like Margaret Sangster, she had sort of narrowed her program to like sort of, birth
Yeah, and
control.
Alice Paul, like a lot of the suffragettes generation were actually still alive. They were in their 70s and 80s at the time, but they were considered so oppressively passe. Like actually the way that young people in Betty Friedan's era understood first wave suffragette feminism is almost identical to the way we and our young people in our era understand second wave feminism. It's like those are old white ladies. They are out of touch. We got what they wanted, and now they're just kind of continuing to complain. It's a narcissistic and excessive enterprise, right? Like that's just sort of like the idea. But without feminism, without feminism in that era when Friedan was writing, it turned out you actually need a kind of continuous feminist force, because cultural inertia will like and the forces of misogyny actively will impose a gender hierarchy, which like women, actual real world women, including ones who are not heavily politicized, will find like entirely unsatisfactory. And so in that way, I think you're right that her moment of confronting an anti-feminist backlash that had been like largely victorious and trying to revive a feminist movement has a lot of parallels to our moment right now.
Yeah, and I'll mention with the suffragettes, as it happened, I had recently been watching with my daughters Mary Poppins, and I hadn't seen the movie for a long time and had totally forgotten that the mother of the family in Mary Poppins is a suffragette, and she's exactly kind of portrayed as, you know, I mean, the whole motion of the plot is that because she's so caught up in this cause and neglecting her family that they need the intervention of this divine force of traditional femininity in the form of Mary Poppins. Anyways, but otherwise, a fine movie. But I think
the trad wife comes in to save the children. Yeah.
Yeah, if you do watch it with your kids, perhaps have a little conversation. In any case, I mean that is her moment, and then she leverages, which I think is also quite impressive, because I mean we've had people who have had like you know really successful books that deal with a topical issue and then remain authors. I think the other interesting thing about her is that she leverages that into like an actual political movement of, you know, creating the National Organization for Women now. Maybe to talk about that. I mean, I think that makes sense in light of her like larger political history, that she had this sort of prior political formation. That led her to like be interested not just in being a best-selling writer, but the leader of a mass political movement.
Yeah, Betty Friedan did not start off exactly with the ambition of being like a literary celebrity. She started off on the political left. So like you mentioned, when she went to college, she's from small town Illinois. She's literally from Peoria. She was born in Peoria, Illinois in 1921 and came east for college and went to Smith. And that's where she sort of had this political awakening in just sort of like the war time and immediately pre-World War II era as a communist. And she really became quite committed to communism in a way that was not yet taboo on the American left, before World War II. So, you know, she later went to graduate school in Berkeley and she tried to join the East Bay branch of the Communist Party, and they're like, no, you're too intellectual, you're not allowed to be here, which like have you met any communists? They're all intellectuals. But they didn't want her, and you know, meanwhile the we only know this because there's
when I read that part in your essay, if there wasn't some sort of gender dynamic there as well, like it's not that she's an intellectual, because they had like, you know, like people
yeah
like
they had a lot of
right?
male intellectuals right yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, and we only know about this scene, of course, because there was an FBI informant in the corner, like frantically scribbling notes, and this wound up in her FBI file. The FBI was monitoring Betty Friedan from the time she was about 20 years old. Mm-hmm. Her file contains essays she wrote in high school. Mm-hmm. So she was on their radar very, very young. And, you know, she did have a degree of paranoia, especially sort of at the height of her career. The sense that she was going to be labeled a radical and exiled. And part of that comes, like, frankly, because she had been so deeply involved with the communist left in her extreme youth. She had, like, dated a bunch of guys in Oppenheimer's lab, actually. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the 1950s, when she's a married woman, she starts seeing all of her ex-boyfriends get hauled in front of Joseph McCarthy. And what happened to them served as her like a stark reminder of what happens when you stray outside of the mainstream. So she had this like political realignment in response to the Red Scare, in response to like these personal experiences that made her much more wary of the dangers of being seen as extreme.
That's right. The sort of McCarthyism is very formative, and I think that actually explains, although it doesn't excuse, some of the homophobia that, like, as I think historians have demonstrated, the period of McCarthyism was also the period of the Lavender Scare, and the two are combined. That the sort of accusations of homosexuality were used to weed people out of the federal bureaucracy, and sort of covert communism and covert homosexuality were seen as overlapping and intertwined dangers. And so, for someone like Smith, who had been part of the radical left, had seen it destroyed by the instruments of the state, and had seen how homophobia had been deployed as part of that counter-revolution and that social purge. I mean, these are all like very formative experiences, telling her, like where the dangers are.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. But I also think, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, and I can go back to the biography because you asked me about the formation of NOW. And the National Organization for Women was a group that Free Dan founded really in cooperation with a few other women, but especially Pauli Murray, the legal scholar, in 1966. And the thing about Betty Friedan and her call for a feminist revival is that, like, she popularized the idea, but she didn't, like, invent it, right? So in policy circles in and around Washington, there were a lot of women working for particularly the Democratic Party and also particularly labor unions, who had seen failures of the civil rights and labor movements to sort of grapple in ways that they felt were appropriate and serious enough with the issue of women's equality. There was frustration with women's backsliding, in terms of their social status, income, workforce participation, life options. This had been a retreat from the public sphere that had happened in the 1940s and 50s, and these women were frustrated with that, the same way that Friedan was. And then what really fucking pissed them off was the lack of enforcement of Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So in 1964, the Civil Rights Act passed. Title VII is a provision within that Civil Rights Act that prohibits discrimination in employment. And in Title VII, there's a prohibition, federal prohibition, on sex discrimination in employment. And, to enforce this, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is established. It's a whole new federal agency meant to enforce non-discrimination law by employers. And the EEOC commissioners consider the sex discrimination ban in the law as a joke. They start referring to it as the bunny law because they're like, if we enforce this, we would have to make men be Playboy bunnies at the Playboy Club. They were like literally laughing about it, right? But meanwhile, they're getting tons and tons and tons of sex discrimination complaints at the EEOC. There's, the New York Times is running sex segregated help wanted ads. Like, these are the good jobs that men can get, and here on this other page are the bad jobs that women have to settle for. Flight attendants are being fired at the age of 32, or if they're over 125 pounds. There's not a word yet for what we call sexual harassment, but it's a endemic feature of women's experience in paid work. And this stuff is not really in the popular consciousness the way that it is now, but that does not mean that women are okay with it. They're actually profoundly pissed off and looking to the state for redress in accordance with the law, and the EEOC is refusing to enforce it.
Yeah, no, and in terms of, I mean, I'm really glad you mentioned Pauli Murray because, like, she represents, the sort of legal side of this, and like, she's African American woman. For our later discussion, when we return to the issue of just sort of homophobia, very interesting because, it's clear from her biography she had throughout her life said that she was a man trapped in a woman's body, but
And
she's also
relationships with women,
yes.
sexual relationships were seemingly exclusively with women.
Yeah, and was a pioneer of the idea of a legal strategy on the issue of civil rights, and then later on the issue of women's rights. That is to say that, like in the sort of early 20th century, it was like unclear what was the best path forward for overcoming Jim Crow and segregation. And she was like one of the real pioneers that said, like the key instrument of the state and the power of the state is in the laws, that if we can get, Plessy versus Ferguson overturned, if we can get civil rights laws overturned, that will be an instrument of power. And more crucially, to distinguish that between later forms of legal liberalism, that's in combination with social mobilization, that you both
Right.
get the laws in place, and then you get people who understand these laws, or are taught about these laws and what their rights actually are, and can mobilize to push for them in the real world. I think that's a sort of crucial component. And I would say that Betty Friedan herself then becomes very important, because if you have people that are starting to put in, the proper legal language, and it's not enforced, then you need a popularizer, someone who can name the problem. I think that's a crucial part of the feminine mystique. People had this, as you say, discontent. Women had this discontent, but they didn't have a name for it. And she was the one who named it. And that's like just a
She
huge
called it the
thing.
problem that has no name.
Yeah.
But here's you're describing a social change strategy I've heard called suits and boots, which is this idea that you need both people who can manipulate existing institutions, seek reform or enforcement of existing rules, who can be, playing on the terms of the elite. And that's something that, people like Pauli Murray are great at. Those are lawyers, those are lobbyists. ACT UP was in this model as well. They had sort of an insider group. The NAACP, which now is eventually modeled on, had this model. But then you don't just need them, right? You also need a massive group of people who can take to the streets and who can impose pressure in these sort of less institutionally refined ways. So you need both the suits in the courtroom and the boots on the street. Suits and boots. I think it's cute. But
Yeah,
you know this
no. Yeah, and it describes the actual, the way the movement came together in the 1960s. And I would add, in our discussion of Friedan, there tends to be a tension between the suits and the boots, right? The
Yes,
people who
yeah.
are, there's an inherent going to be conflicts over
They
local.
don't trust each other.
Yeah, they
Yeah,
trust
this
each other.
is.
Because they have a different orientation and different focus in what they should be doing. Even though one can see them working together on a macro level, but that's not how it's felt existentially.
Yeah,
Existentially, it's felt like.
retaining those allegiances is the impossible task that virtually every group fails. I actually think for a really good account of this, readers should consider picking up Sarah Schulman's History of ACT UP called Let the Record Show. It's an absolute doorstop of a book. It's like 800 pages, but it's a really good illustration of how the alliance between the people on those two tracks eventually, it was very, very effective for some years and then eventually broke down, which is something, that we can also see happen towards now, sort of later in its history. But what happens is that, there is this discontent among the elites. And these credentialed experts in Washington. There's not a ton of women working in politics. The parties at the time had what were called ladies auxiliaries, which is where if you were a woman working in politics, you had to sort of go and sit at the kids' table. But there were enough of them. This woman named Catherine East in particular, who's a Democratic Party operative, was very well connected. And they sort of came to Friedan and they're like, be our big public face. Make our like transform our backroom pressure campaign into a legitimate social movement that can pressure the federal government from the outside. And that's where we find Betty Friedan in her hotel room in Washington, D.C. in 1966, mm-hmm. with a room full of very drunk women, trying to, you know, from various states, who are involved in sort of advocacy for women's rights, trying to get them all to sign on to this. And she winds, and it winds, turns into a screaming fight.
Mm-hmm.
it's an amazing scene, and yeah, I had read about it before. You know, Pauli Murray, they call this meeting of these women, everybody's in town for this big conference, so they call a meeting, and it's after this big reception at the State Department that had apparently been very boozy. So everybody kind of staggers in at like midnight to Betty Friedan's hotel suite at the Washington Hilton, and they're like, oh, it's a party. Like, Betty's having us here for a party. And then they're still drinking. They're drinking from the mini bar. And Pauli Murray gets up clutching her little yellow legal pad and begins to talk in her very proper Pauli Murray way about this new organization she wants to launch, like called that she's calling the NAACP for Women. But, oh, why don't we call it NOW?
Mm-hmm.
And these women who are kind of just there to have a good time are like, God, do we need to? Do we have to? Do we really want to? Can't we just work with, you know, within the existing structures? And Betty Friedan, in very typical Betty Friedan fashion, screams at everybody, tries to throw them out, and then locks herself in the bathroom.
It's quite the scene. I'll just say, like, tangentially, like, you know, we can kind of maybe historicize the drinking there. You know, I mean, this is the sort of Mad Men era. You know, like, people are at that period are, you know, drink much more, especially in things like sort of, you know, conventions and political events. And then also, like, you know, although men like, you know, Teddy Kennedy were obviously huge alcoholics, there's a little bit of a gender dimension as well, in the sense that, you know, like, in this oppressive patriarchal world, you know, like, alcohol was one of the means of self-medication. It was like, you know, mother's little helper, as it was known. So it kind of, you know, the drinking, you know, it has, like, we could sort of understand it historically, but it is like quite the scene. But I mean, I think it makes it all the more impressive that Murray and Friedan were able to, like, you know, get everyone, you know, they were actually able, you know, within that chaos to actually create this organization. And then I think, you know, what the suits and boots strategy, I think, really kicks in once you have NOW, as the sort of megaphone, phone, or the, you know, like, the voice of discontent that people can rally around. And I think, like, you know, in your piece, it comes out very strongly. The interesting thing is, like, how many women who are not otherwise politicized or politicized in the way of a left social movement get attracted once they see, oh, you know, there's this organization, it's concerned about, like, you know, what's happening to women, it's concerned, I mean, especially very pertinent now, like, abortion is a huge rallying cry, because that's something that, like, you know, then as now, a lot of women, like, experience in their lives, and that's something that, you know, cuts across all demographics and political lines.
And even if you don't experience it, you have to think about it, right?
Yeah.
Because it always could be you. Yeah.
Or you know someone, or, you know, you have an aunt or a mom that had an abortion. Like, it's just like woven into the fabric of everyone's life.
Yeah. And that was, you know, 1966 is a pre-Roe era. And it is an era of, you know, part of the anti-feminist backlash of the 1940s and 50s was sort of renewed and often quite draconian enforcement of abortion bans that had been, like, sort of more laxly enforced in prior eras, which, and then an attendant surge in women's mortality rates, right? So, you know, Betty Friedan really shapes NOW in her own image. She's
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
First president, she served for 4 years until 1970, and she sets out a series of goals. The first is like actual Title VII enforcement and employment non-discrimination. She wants abortion rights. Mm-hmm. She wants the ERA, and she wants a national child care program. Title VII enforcement has been weakened in the ensuing decades, but they got it. Like the EEOC considers sex discrimination to be banned in federal law now. And they did not when Betty Friedan started, and they probably wouldn't have if Betty Friedan hadn't been on their ass. They worked very hard to change public opinion on abortion, which did facilitate the Roe v. Wade decision. We have lost that since. But we gained it in no small part because of NOW's work, and also because of Betty Friedan's work, because partly another thing she did during this era was found NARAL, which is, you know, a whole other large women's rights organization, National Association for the Appeal of Abortion Laws, which I believe has since changed its acronym. But that was an effort Betty Friedan made to sort of recruit an alliance of healthcare professionals and feminists who had sort of been separate and historically occasionally opposed on the question of abortion rights, but were like coming around to shared support of abortion rights in the 1960s. And Friedan really solidified that alliance with NARAL. Another goal she had was National Child Care Program, which they very nearly got. It passed the Senate. It passed the House. President Nixon was about an inch from signing it, and then Pat Buchanan, his arch conservative speechwriter, convinced him not to. And everybody in the country, by the end of Friedan's term as president of NOW, considered the ERA a pretty much done deal. Mm-hmm. They're like, this is so banal. Of course we're going to pass the ERA. And then an ally of Buchanan's, Phyllis Schlafly, with substantial financial backing from groups like the Mormon Church, organized to, you know, rally the far right and defeat the ERA. So, you know, she, Friedan's legacy and NOW's legacy was one that really changed our world. And it is one that has been chipped away at very slowly and deliberately, and now we are much more vulnerable to losing the gains that her work enabled us to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and that's one reason why I was thinking, you know, after reading your article, like how relevant her life is for NOW, because it seems like a lot of the same issues, you know, that politicized her and mobilized her and mobilized NOW in the 1960s are like again pertinent, and a lot of the same strategic questions are very pertinent again. Now, you know, at the start I had sort of said, you know, problematic fave, because, you know, like obviously, like, you know, like the case you've laid out is for her importance, I think, is like is huge. I mean, this is like, you know, someone who was responsible for and helped incite a movement that was responsible for, like, you know, these major transformative changes in American society. You know, like, but she's always been someone, you know, like, that people have had mixed feelings about. And so do you want to like outline what some of the reasons for that are?
Well, she was absolutely impossible. You know, this is there. I think there were like two times just in my piece where she gets so upset that she throws a tantrum and locks herself in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And I was on the phone.
I was thinking that was a common strategy, it seems like, for her.
At least I only found two, but like I was on the phone with a fact checker and he's like, how often did she lock herself in the bathroom? Yeah. And I was like, I only know of these two, but like, and another, there's another scene in Rachel Steyer's book, which is one of the ones that I review, in which she doesn't get her way and she sort of like slams the phone and then sort of like stomps her feet like a child. You know, she's irascible, and she can make these like great displays of woundedness, right? That's like kind of, I think, like an ordinary human failure.
True. Right? I see
in Friedan somebody with like,
I should add, I mean, like, if you're thinking about it, like, you know, like, you know, these sort of like psychological quirks and problems are like, you know, like not unknown in like, you know, male leaders. Like, I would not say Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon, you know, her contemporaries are like, you know, models of psychological health.
Women are held to a higher behavioral standard, right? And like, we see her personality flaws as like eclipsing her accomplishments instead of the other way around. And we just don't assess men that way. But I think the thing that really has left the stain on Friedan's legacy was her homophobia, and in particular her homophobia towards lesbians, which was like sort of the bulk of her homophobic attention was directed at women. Although the feminine mystique does have some nice like shivs at gay men. She's like, housewives become overly attentive and obsessed with their sons, which makes those sons gay, which is why we need to get women into the workforce. And I'm like, is that really why? she was focusing on lesbians who were increasingly visible and increasingly out within the women's liberation movement, the second wave feminist movement of the late 1960s and early 70s. And there's a few reasons for this. There, you know,
well, we had talked about just to circle back, we had mentioned earlier the sort of lavender scare of the 1940s and late 40s and early 50s. There are other reasons as well.
Yeah, you know, there's a nascent gay rights movement in the post-Stonewall era. There is sort of independent, like an intellectually independent lineage of like radical feminist thought that comes to embrace lesbianism as like one legitimate expression of feminist identity. There is an increasing, you know, like Betty Friedan comes from the far left, but I would position her very solidly as a liberal feminist, right? There is sort of independently emerging from the new left, as opposed to Friedan's old left, from the new left, like anti-war, civil rights, anti-draft movements. There is a new kind of radical feminism emerging among people who are, you know, like 10, 15 years younger than Friedan. And they are much more interested in sexual politics. They are much more interested in like how heterosexuality is constructed, how the family is constructed, how marriage and motherhood and dating are all sort of arranged around a presumption of women's like self-sacrifice and submission, right? And Friedan is kind of allergic to that shit. She's like, why would I give a crap about your personal life? And she sees the rise of a lesbian rights claim and the sort of like mass coming out of lesbians that was happening in this era as symptomatic of this like intellectual failure. But I actually think that you can explain this in part through Friedan's own biography. Because Friedan was a woman who had had like horrifically bad luck with heterosexuality. I don't think this like explains all of her views or like is, you know, a particularly useful way to assess feminists in general, but I think with Friedan, it's really interesting. You know, she had this background in psychology, which was like a field she left in part because like she couldn't stomach the misogyny in the field's theoretical foundations. Like there's a scene of, you know, she's on a date with this psychology graduate student and he's like trying to like nag her by telling her about like the theory of penis envy. She gets sexually assaulted by one of her graduate school professors. She gets sexually assaulted by a couple of other dates. But she just can't get like in her like very young life, she just can't get boys to like her. Like men just don't, they're just not really interested in Betty. She's like very serious. She's very like intellectually ambitious. She's not like the prettiest girl. And then she winds up marrying this kind of piece of shit guy, Carl Friedan, who like almost immediately starts like A, cheating on and B, beating her. She has a horrific marriage. And like Betty is very disappointed in heterosexuality. And she kind of, but she never gives up on it, right? She's always trying to make it work. And one of her rationales for feminism is like, no, we need feminism to redeem heterosexuality. We need feminism for love to work so that, you know, we can have this great flowering of affinity between equals and not be sort of kept from each other by this hierarchy and inequality. You know, sort of the accusation leveled against feminists, or at least the one that's been leveled against me, right, is that like you're a lesbian because you failed at heterosexuality, right? And Friedan's personal sense of having failed at heterosexuality made her a virulent anti-lesbian homophobe, and like made her really double down on like trying to succeed at and redeem this project of you know, marriage and heterosexual partnership.
That's so interesting. I mean, because, you know, I mean, she was adverse to sort of politicizing the personal realm, but in some ways she herself had already done that. Like she had, you know, made the heterosexual family the sort of normative bulwark that we have to make work. That is, I mean, by your account, that seems like the basis of the sort of project. And I mean, a couple of things you said I want to sort of tease out. I mean, we, as mentioned earlier, the sort of formation, you know, of like, you know, McCarthyism and the Lavender Scare thing. And then, but you mentioned that she was, you know, understood very early on, and this was going really against the grain of the 40s and 50s, the misogynist basis of like, a, you know, a lot of Freudian and other, you know, psychological models. And but she seems to have bought into the homophobic basis of those theories, right? Like, because her idea is like, you know, the gay men are created by, you know, overprotective mothers, you know, is pretty standard. And so it is interesting the degree to which, you know, she is both buying into, you know, this very heteronormative model of the family, even as she is aware, as much as anyone is, you know, of like all its problems.
She really thinks that the way that you fix marriage and the family and like sort of create happiness within the home, which is like a unit she doesn't really question, right? She assumes that there's going to be a family home, and that there needs to be harmony within it. She thinks that the way you get there is by creating as much formal and like practicable equality outside the home as possible. And like, there's a degree to which like that is a decent argument. Like if you want to make it harder for men to like beat and rape, you know, the women in their private orbit, one way to do it is to make sure those women have enforceable legal rights that are taken seriously. One way to do it is make sure that those women have money so that they can like leave or sue his ass. You know, and these are another way to do it is to, you know, make sure that the law and the culture outside the home are enforcing women's dignity so that it doesn't seem so rational and acceptable to like beat and rape women in private. So, you know, she's not crazy, but she did kind of, she's not crazy strategically, right? Mm-hmm. But I think her political understanding of these, you know, quote unquote, private sphere aspects of women's oppression as somehow lesser, I think it blinkered and blinded her. And, you know, she was like not like passively homophobic. In the way that I think we would like maybe like forgive a lot of people of that generation for being, or at least expect them to be, right? She was quite actively homophobic. Mm-hmm. She referred to lesbians as the quote unquote lavender menace. Mm-hmm. She threatened to out NOW's executive director, who at the time was married to a man, and sort of like quite, it sounds like quite seriously and painfully struggling with her lesbian identity. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like she was cruel. She got women fired for being gay, like crazy shit. And it was really, and like to her credit, she changed her mind on this eventually, but not before she had really thoroughly lost the fight within the feminist movement. Because this isn't, you know, when I went into this writing this piece and reading more about Ferdinand, I thought of NOW as institutionally homophobic, right? Mm-hmm. I assumed that this was something that her fellow leaders in the group endorsed, that it was something that the group's membership sort of like implicitly or explicitly endorsed. And that's in fact not the case at all. This was mm-hmm. Betty's problem. And the rank and file made it clear that they were not on her side and that they, you know, wanted to embrace lesbian rights, or at least not exclude lesbians as fiercely as Friedan wanted to. So like the respectability politics that Friedan was very fiercely advocating for, by even the early 70s, they were like losing an appeal among the liberal feminists, sort of shock troops that she was relying on to make NOW a relevant national organization.
Yeah, and not just liberal feminists. I mean, like, it's sort of interesting that even the sort of, you know, that she wanted to get, you know, respectable Republican women on board. And even those at that time, and then this might have changed later, but at that time, we're not like into homophobia the degree that she was, right? Like, so,
Catherine Turk's book, The Women of NOW, which is one of the two books that I reviewed, features this woman, Patricia Hill Burnett, who was a Detroit housewife, and like she was like I'm a philanthropist, I like to paint watercolors, and she was drawn to NOW in large part because of their support for abortion rights. Mm-hmm. And you know, she was Friedan's idea of a perfect ideal NOW member. She was a upper middle class, you know, sort of elite conservative woman. She had been Miss Michigan in her youth. She was like very pretty. And she was like, I have no appetite for this anti-lesbian shit. She was like, I don't, she's like, this seems pointless. Men hate all feminists anyway. Like there's no point in capitulating to respectability politics because we're just weakening ourselves. Mm-hmm. So this was not like, you know, Betty Friedan very much saw herself as sort of protecting NOW from the judgment of mainstream women, from the rejection of mainstream women with her homophobia, right? She thought it as like strategically smart. But these like mainstream women who she's imagining are not really like lining up enthusiastically behind a homophobic message. They're kind of like shrugging at it.
Yeah. Well, and I think that actually has also sort of resonance for NOW, because I mean, one does see, you know, like a kind of on the left, like a kind of argument for, you know, transphobic views on the idea, well, you know, like trans politics alienates people, and it's you know, we have to like, you know, win a large coalition. And the thing is, you know, I mean, I've talked about this before on the podcast, like there's not a lot of like electoral evidence of this. Like I think actual like transphobia, you know, doesn't really do that well, like politically, especially like, you know, in actual contested elections. But beyond that, like the people making that argument, I mean, it seems like a bad faith argument. Like you're conjuring up a popular transphobia to justify your own policy preferences. And I feel like that's what Friedan was doing a bit, like you know, conjuring up. We have to appeal to these hypothetical, like, you know, women who would support feminism, but would be alienated by lesbianism. But that's actually, like, because you know, she herself was homophobic, right? I don't want to be, like, too, like, crudely cynical, but I mean, that does seem to be the move, right? Like, you justify
it's not me. It's like bigotry by proxy. It's like you invent somebody else who's a bigot to justify your own bigotry. But like also, you know, Friedan's focus on respectability politics really does remind me a lot of like the contemporary reactionary centrist position and sort of like the reflexive, you know, democratic political consultant idea that you're always pitching to the Trump voter in a diner in Ohio, right? And like assuming that that person's like A is a majority, B like can be persuaded to like support you in the first place, and like C is intensely motivated by the things that you're assuming they're motivated by, is a persistent fantasy even without evidence, right? Like the evidence that I think we're seeing piled upon us both in Friedan's era and ours, is it like abortion rights? Is it like incredibly popular and that you can garner a ton of support by backing them and by making them a central issue, and that, you know, homophobia, transphobia, queerphobia, it's certainly very alienating to, or very animating to some people, but only a small minority who are never really going to be on your side anyway. Like the trans thing, kids in sports, you know, 90% of voters are going to be like, what are you talking about? What's wrong with you? Who could possibly give a shit? Like, they're not motivated by this. Like, even the people who might be, you know, persuadable to a transphobic argument don't feel as strongly about it as the people informing us so breathlessly that this is their number one issue, you know?
I think that's absolutely right, and I think it's the degree to which respectability politics depends upon creating a fantasy of a popular base that is winnable, like and rather than, like, you know, trying to actually build the coalition that you already have and work with the people that are already on your side. Or
taking any responsibility for persuasion. You know, the thing about like politics, law, these big organizations like Now, is that they don't have to just conform or like shape themselves around public opinion. They have have some influence, at least, over changing public opinion. And that was something that Friedan actually was quite willing to do on some issues, like the ERA and abortion rights. Neither of them, those was like especially popular when she took them on. But she found that they were sort of paramount importance to her, that she was willing to do something that risked alienating her allies, right? Like that risked undermining relationships that were important to her. Like the unions were a huge part of Now's early coalition. Like one of the things you learn when you study the second wave is that like a lot of second wave feminism was only possible because of the presence of labor unions and women's heavy enrollment in labor unions, in a way that like sort of makes the idea of reviving that kind of national feminist project seem really impossible today. But they didn't support the ERA, and when at Now's second annual convention, like Betty Friedan like pushes through endorsement of the ERA, all the union women walk out because their union doesn't allow them to be a part of a organization that's lobbying for the ERA, you know. And she was willing to do that because she thought it was important enough. She wasn't willing to do it with the lesbians, which I think would have cost her less. Ultimately, opposing lesbian rights cost her much more than I think opposing them would have ever gotten her.
And then that does sort of point to her her personal political tragedy, but then I think also resonates with a lot of issues like Now. Like there are people who, you know, like are picking hills to die on that I think are very strange hills. that's also, I mean, I think it's always useful when you're in politics to step back and think like, why am I like, you know, making this the, you know, the litmus test and the thing that I will like, you know, destroy everything for. But I mean, like, you know, having stepped back, I mean, you know, in your piece, and I'm very glad that you bring this note and sort of end on this note was, you know, like for all the sort of, you know, criticism that we have of her, you know, and then these are like major important criticisms, you know, there's still this sense of achievement. And I think you really bring out like all the contradictions with the story of the general strike in like 1970. Do you want to just like, maybe that's a nice note to end on, because it both brings out her difficulty as a person, but then also how that was actually good in a movement leader.
Yeah, so Friedan, she leaves the presidency of NOW in 1970. And she's at this meeting in March of 1970, sort of handing over the reins to her successor, Eileen Hernandez, who's a really interesting figure in her own right, a Black women's rights activist who sort of a protege of Polly Murray's and had been active in the labor rights movement. And as she's delivering her like sort of farewell to NOW speech, she announces with no prior warning to anybody else that 5 months from that day in August of 1970, NOW was going to throw a nationwide women's general strike. To which everybody in the audience goes, "Are you fucking kidding me?" You know, and like all these women who NOW suddenly have to organize a massive action and don't feel equipped to do it and don't feel like they have enough time. And don't feel, you know, and you know, Betty's saying this like into a news camera, you know. And it's sort of this trick that commits NOW to something very ambitious. And, you know, to these women's great credit, they really pull it off. It was an unexpected runaway success. Tens of thousands of women participate across the country and in other countries. People stop going to work, they walk out of their jobs, they stop taking care of their kids, they stop having sex and doing housework, they are in the streets demanding equality, and it is a massive coalition, much bigger than what Friedan imagined for NOW. There's older women, there's lesbians, there's student groups, there's Black women radical groups, there's like all this vast swath of the American female population coming in for this collective effort at gender equality and their own liberation. And this, you know, the sort of premise of NOW is one that I think has gone like really out of fashion, which is that all women share an interest in the same political project of feminism. That's like actually a wildly ambitious, optimistic, difficult strategy that Friedan herself found it like difficult to really adhere to and believe in, right? But when it was done well, it had this electrifying effect that changed the country, I think really dramatically for the better. And it was a wonderful moment.
It's a great moment. And I will have a link to Myra's article, which people can read about all this. And you can also read her other writings in The Guardian and listen to her podcast, In Bed with the Right. More Myra Donegan is out there for everyone who wants it. So again, thank you once again for being on the program.
Thanks, Gene. I had a blast.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.